Okay, so we had some, it's just started raining here in Parramatta, so a few people are struggling. I don't know if you heard that.
Yeah.
Online, you heard that? Yeah. So that was thunder.
Oh.
Crikey. So some metta for all the poor dogs around the place. And also for all the children going out on Halloween tonight. Very appropriate. Right? Trick or treating and in the thunderstorm. Yes, that's excellent. So I've told this while we're just waiting for a couple of people to come. We'll just tell you my Halloween story in case you haven't heard it. So personally, look, I'm just going to say it, okay? Halloween is an American thing, and we should not be doing it in Australia. It's just my thing. Okay, so, but I was in New York and was staying in Rockaway with the Insight group, and also Darcy and Ronald Soma, and we had a talk in Manhattan. So we go on the train to go into Manhattan, and it was Halloween. So everyone's like, oh, yeah, sick costume, bro. And like, yeah, no, it's actually just monks. Yeah, that's just how we dress anyway. All right, so I'm Bhante Sujato, and we're joining you here today from Parramatta on the banks of the Parramatta River, the land where the place where the eels lay down. And we pay respects to the Parramattical people of the Darug Nation, upon whose land, unceded land, we live and sit, and upon whose land we pursue our spiritual practices. And one of the experiences that we've had as Buddhists here in Australia is that in our encounters with Indigenous people, and we have always found Indigenous people to be very welcoming and very inclusive and very curious about the practices that we're undertaking as Buddhists. Many times where we find that there are similarities and crossovers. For example, when I was in Perth, talking with one Aboriginal elder about meditation, he said, yeah, we have our own meditation system. You know, so he said, meditation practice. So when he feels like, he said, but it's not like your meditation, but he said, what he does is that when he feels like there's an imbalance, like he feels like something, there's an energy imbalance, something's out of whack, then he'll go off into the forest and just sit down under a tree and just sit there and just let his mind go out and like feel all the spirits or all the energies and then let them talk to him. And so he just lets all the energies or the spirits of the place talk to him, and just to sort of seek and sort of find what that balance is. So that was a really interesting, I thought, description of meditation. It really reminded me of how if we look in even in early Buddhist meditation, that there is a lot of connection with nature as part of it, like meditating through the four elements and so on. So I feel that these differences are not perhaps as marked as one might think. Anyhow, let us proceed with some chanting, and we will chant our devotions for the Triple Gem in Pali.
Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhang saranang gacchami, dhammang saranang gacchami, sanghang saranang gacchami, dutiyam pi buddhang saranang gacchami, Andutiyam pidhammang saranang gacchami. Dutiyam pisangkang saranang gacchami. Tatiyam pibuddhang saranang gacchami. Tatiyam pidhammang saranang gacchami. Tatiyam pisangkang saranang gacchami.
So I will just pause for a moment. It seems to be leaking in the building here. So just we're just seeing if we can fix that. Okay. It's coming through the aircon unit, is it? So sorry, everybody, but yeah, the rain's coming down. Hi. Okay. It's leaking. Sorry, everybody online, just give us a minute and we are just.
Light down, Anna.
Okay. Okay. Oh, thank you. Yeah.
Are you staying in Meriton?
That's correct. Yeah.
We are also staying in Meriton.
What?
In a Meriton.
Okay. Well, there you go. Some of my neighbors, my new neighbors. All right, so let us continue. Iti piso bhagava raham samma sambuddho vijja charana sampanno sugato lokavidu anuttaro purisa dhamma sarathi Sattha deva manusanam buddho bhagavati svakato bhagavata dhammo sandirthiko akaliko ehipasiko opanaiko pachatam veditabho vinyuhiti Supatipanno bhagavato savaka sangho Ujupatipanno bhagavato savaka sangho Nyayapatipanno bhagavato savaka sangho Samichipatipanno bhagavato savaka sangho Yadidam chattari purisa yugani yatta purisa pungala Esa bhagavato savaka sangho
Ahuneyo, pahuneyo, dakirneyo, jalikaraniyo, anutarang punyaketang lokasati.
Okay, very good. All right, so I'll say a few words about meditation, then we'll do some guided meditation together. For this evening's talk, so according to the weather report from Venerable Prasanna, 3 separate storms descending on Sydney and 2 in the Central Coast right now. Excellent. Sounds like a metaphor for something, but anyway, we'll just leave it at that. So for this evening, what I would like to do we'll do as usual, we'll do some meditation. And then for the main Dhamma session, I'd like to ask, we can do a Q&A session for today, okay? So I'm conscious that over the last while, since I've been doing dependent origination, I've been talking a lot. I don't know, time for you to say something. Anyway, so look, if you have any questions for the folks online, please do pop them into the chat or you can speak if we want to afterwards. And yeah, so now is the time to get all of those questions answered, if we can. All right. So meditation, here we are. Once again, end of the week. Everything is winding down. From a Buddhist point of view, when the ending of things is happiness, te sang rupa samo sukho, and the beginning of things is suffering, jati pi dukkha. And so if we reach the ending of things, then it's nice to be able to reach the ending of things with grace. Sometimes when things end, maybe the end of the work day, the end of the week, then we reach that end with exhaustion. Right. So what do we do when we're exhausted? Then we react unskillfully. We have a drink or something like that, and we take all of that stress. We react to exhaustion with coffee, so sometimes skillfully. Also, yes, there are skillful responses as well. Thank you for that. And we react to those things in those different ways. Now, stress in life is always there. And hard work has always been there. But it really is amazing how much of our lives are driven by things that are really just make work, things that are just like we just create problems in our minds through our intentions or our expectations, and we get very stressed about fulfilling those things. And there's a whole range of things that's actually quite easy for us to let go of if we just don't worry about them too much. I'm not saying everything is like that. I'm just saying that some things are like that. So when we reach the end of the day, there are many things that's happened maybe at work, many things that happened maybe in the family, maybe in your colleagues or friends or neighbors, and we can carry those burdens with us into the weekend if we like. We can bring all of that suffering, all of that mess, and just bear that burden through the weekend and then bring it back with us on Monday. Yay! That's one way. Or we can struggle unskillfully to forget it by distracting ourselves or blitzing our brains with drugs or something like that. But the reality is, and I know that you're probably going to not like this, but the reality is that it's easy to let things go and hard to hold them. Yeah. Carrying the burden is suffering, and carrying the burden is difficult. Letting go is easy. Yet somehow we've convinced ourselves that carrying the burden is not only easy, but it's necessary. No, we don't convince ourselves that it's easy, but we convince ourselves that it's necessary, that we have to carry these burdens. And look, sometimes we do have those responsibilities. But a lot of the times, we actually have a lot of burdens that we can simply put down. Things that we can't solve, things that we can't change. It's good and appropriate to be concerned about suffering that's happening in the world, about the suffering of the people in Jamaica with the devastating storm and other people in that region. But our worry doesn't help them. They're not made happier by our suffering. In fact, I'm going to go out on a limb and say Jamaicans, to my knowledge, are generally a pretty chill people. And they probably just would wish that we would be happy as well. And that's probably actually, like, we can help and we can donate to charity and we can do those things. But at the end of the day, carrying their burden is not helping them. So we learn to let go. And meditation is a crash course in letting go. In meditation, we confront those things that are inescapable, things like our thoughts, our memories, our desires, our fears. They are just there, raw and unadulterated, uninterpreted. We can't escape them or pretend that they don't exist. They are simply there. And so we get to let go right at the coalface of experience. Not in a general way, not in a vague way, but in a very specific way, this thing, this moment, this thought. If the thought of letting go of all of our attachments and cravings and greed, hatred, and delusion, if the thought of that is too much, then maybe in this minute, or maybe in the 20 minutes of the meditation that we'll be doing soon, maybe we can let go of at least one thing. Maybe we can let go of, if we can let go of one thing, we can probably let go of two things. And the funny thing is, actually, for the period of meditation, if we give ourselves permission, and if our attention is clear, and if our mindfulness is strong, we can let go of a lot in just 20 minutes of meditation. We can go from feeling stressed, angry, frazzled, tired, to feeling peaceful and balanced and content just from 20 minutes of just sitting there and being aware of the breath. It's amazing, really. It's a truly incredible thing that that's possible. And this practice that was bequeathed to us by the Buddha, proven and practiced down for 2,500 years. And through the simple practice of observing the breath coming in and the breath going out, we bring to ourselves a peace that is unmatched. Let's do some meditation. mindfully breathing in, mindfully breathing out, mindfully breathing in, mindfully breathing out, mindfully breathing in, mindfully breathing out. Mindfully breathing in, mindfully breathing out, noticing the point at which the breath starts, noticing the whole course of the breath, noticing the point at which the breath stops. Mindfully breathing in, mindfully breathing out, mindfully breathing in, mindfully breathing out.
All those worries, all of those burdens, all of those fears, those expectations, they're just nothing. Ask yourself, what are those things actually? What substance is there to them? What weight is there to them? What power is there to them? These things do not have a power of themselves. The only power they have is that which we give them. Mindfully breathing in, mindfully breathing out. Mindfully breathing in, mindfully breathing out. and feeling their breath become so soft, so still, that it almost disappears. And how many things have you left behind? How many things are not here? Only this one gentleness that is the breath. Mindfully breathing in, mindfully breathing out, mindfully breathing in, mindfully breathing out. So now coming near to the end of the meditation. And before we stop, I want you to notice that peace inside your breath. I want you to notice all of the things that are not there. How different is it now than when you started the meditation? Such an ease and such a peace. It comes to you from nowhere and it vanishes just as quickly. And within that peace is the key to the truth. Finally, let us dedicate the merit of our practice. May all beings be happy. May all beings be well. May all beings realize Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. All right, let's have a break for a couple of minutes, grab a cup of tea.
come back for some Dhamma talk. And questions, please pop your questions online if you wish. Okay. All right. Very good. So welcome back, everybody. It's a bit of a quiet night tonight, I have to say. A bit quiet here. I think in we have the Meta conference. Is that next weekend? When's that? Meta, is that next weekend, the Meta conference? Yeah. So everyone's kind of preparing for that. Usually what happens around that time. Also, we had our big Katina the other day. Anyway, so we're here today. We'll spend a little bit of time. And I just wanted to have a bit of a casual chat, see how everyone's going. And, yeah, if you can put your cameras on, that's appreciated. We can see who's here. From Esther. Esther, how's things going in Vienna? Hope you're doing well. Ah, please, Bhante Sujata. Would you be so kind to clarify how to understand kaya in the context of jhana? Dankeschön. Okay. Esther, I would be delighted to speak on the nature of kaya in the context of jhana. Thank you so much for that question. All right. So, very good. Just checking everyone's back. Okay, so kaya. Okay, so in the Pali word kaya, K long A Y A is from the root meaning, root from the root chi, as it happens. These are the vagaries of linguistics. Anyway, the root is chi, and the basic meaning of it is to heap up or accumulate. Okay. And a bit similar, like the word body is used in a similar way in English. Like, so you might have like a body of work or the corporate body or something like that. So we use it in that way to mean like an assemblage or a heap or a group of people. But obviously we mostly use the word body to mean this thing here, the physical form. Sabbanga pachanganga hinindriyang, as the Buddha would describe it, complete in all its limbs and not deficient in any faculties. So this is the physical and built up, procreated by mother and father and built up out of rice and bread. So this is the body consisting of the four olarika elements. Okay, and very often in the suttas, when the Buddha is talking about kaya and he's talking about the body, that's what he's talking about. It's just an ordinary word with an ordinary meaning. Curiously enough, though, even though in Buddhism it is an ordinary word with a very ordinary meaning, I don't know if it's actually found in any pre-Buddhist texts. Maybe. I don't know. I've tried to look for it and I haven't really been able to find kaya in that sort of sense before Buddhist texts. But maybe it's a bit of a difficult word to search for. You know, it's just K-A-Y. And there's lots of things in Pali or Sanskrit that are K-A-Y. So it's kind of difficult to search for. So I'm not really sure. But maybe this is a word, one of those words that the Buddha at least prioritized, if not invented. But anyway, so kaya means the body. Now, when we're understanding the body made up of matter in Pali, then we have to understand the two dimensions of matter, the olarika rupa and the sukuma rupa. Okay, so rupa is another word often used for the body or also used for matter in general or used for physical properties and also used to mean a sight or a vision. All right, so rupa and kaya. So the sukuma rupa, or the subtle form, or the sukuma kaya, subtle body, or the olarika rupa is the coarse body, and olarika kaya, the coarse form. Olarika rupa, the coarse form, and olarika kaya, the coarse body. Similar kind of meanings. So you have the olarika and the sukuma. This is a very important distinction in Buddhism, and it's not one that, generally speaking, has an obvious correlate in Western concepts of the body and matter. Now, perhaps it does. I'm not saying that it doesn't have correlates. I'm just saying it's not obvious what those correlates might be. So the coarse body is that which is poked by a doctor, okay? It's that which you feed when you're hungry and that which you clothe when you're cold. That's pretty straightforward. However, the coarse physical body is not quite as obvious as that, is it? Because for a start, okay, so I talked about being poked by a doctor, right? So a doctor might poke you and say, on a scale of 1 to 10, how much does that hurt? I mean, pain doesn't have a scale of 1 to 10. What are you supposed to say? I don't know. 6? I don't know. My point here is that we have an inner representation of our body as well as the external thing. And that external observable body is not always the same as our inner representation. So this is quite, good examples of this is the cases that were popularized or made famous by Oliver Sacks in some of his books, where he talked about how people would have various kinds of cognitive issues that would mean that they somehow got detached from parts of their body. Oliver Sacks is a really good medical writer because he has a way of really humanizing his discussions of these things. So one of the cases might be, say, somebody who wakes up in the morning and then realizes that there's some alien thing in the bed with him, some thing that doesn't belong there, and he tries to throw it out of the bed because it's so disgusting, only to realize that, to his horror, that it's actually attached to him. And he realizes it's his leg. So his inner perception of his body has become disjointed from the external perception. It can happen the other way around, of course. You can have your leg amputated and yet still feel the phantom feelings, right? So these are like those different dimensions. So like I said, I'm not sure that you can like map that idea of the subtle body like literally onto any obvious concept in the way that we talk about things from a Western point of view. But we still kind of recognize some of the phenomena associated with that. And so when we experience the body, the experience of the body includes both these subtle dimensions as well as the coarse dimensions, all right? However you want to characterize that. Perhaps we could think of the subtle body as being an energetic reflection of the coarse body, right? Perhaps it's something like the electromagnetic fields or other fields and so on that's associated with the body. Perhaps it's like an aura or something like that. I think that there is some physical reality that we're talking about here, but I think it's subtle and I don't think it's easy to describe. Anyway, let's just take that for granted right now. Let's assume that there's the subtle form and the coarse form. And these are both meant when the Buddha is talking about the body, all right? So I feel like I may be belaboring this point a little bit, but it's really crucial for understanding this matter. And it is, in my view, one of the key reasons why this point has been systematically misunderstood by modern interpreters, who don't really grok this point that there are these different dimensions of the body. Now, when we begin to meditate, the beginning of most meditation is on some, or at least beginning of many kinds of meditation, is based on some perception of the olarika kaya, of the coarse body. The obvious example being the breath. Right? We just did that mindfulness of breathing meditation and we are paying attention to the breath coming in and coming out. And that breath coming in and coming out is something that a doctor might feel or might touch or might measure. It's something that you can see in the mirror. It's a physical process that has an obvious organic function and which can be measured and which has we can talk about the chemicals involved and all of those things. So this is the olarika kaya, the olarika, the coarse aspect of the breath. Now, as we continue in the breath meditation, what we find is that the breath starts to reveal deeper and more subtle layers, deeper, like hidden dimensions. I'm not talking about like a mystical sense. I'm just saying that there are subtle dimensions to it which you notice when you pay attention. Again, this is not like something that's mysterious. Think about, say, an artwork. You know, you might see a painting or an artwork. You glance at it, you think, oh, that's nice. And if you contemplate it for 5 minutes, 10 minutes, or an hour, more and more dimensions of that are coming out to you. And you, after a long time, you realize, oh, there's a meaning there that I hadn't even seen before. There's all these layers. Yeah. So this is the time, this is what happens over time. We see those deeper layers. So the breath, like an onion, keeps on peeling off and revealing different, deeper layers of that reality, which we call the breath. And as that happens, the nature of the breath changes so that the air, like the physical air element that's moving in and out of the nostrils, changes, becomes more soft, right? Becomes more quiet, becomes soothing, becomes silky. The texture of it changes. But that texture that we're talking about, what is that? That's like a perception. Right? It's a perception in your nostrils, which is a touch perception, but it's also like a feeling in your body because your whole body actually is breathing, right? It's not just, breath isn't just experienced in one point. Your whole body is in fact breathing. And so the whole rhythm of it is affecting everything in your body, which means it's affecting everything in the energetic system in your body. And the deeper you go in, that smoothness and that coolness and that silkiness becomes more prominent. We experience that as pleasure, or we experience that as a light. And a lot of meditators, when the mind becomes very peaceful, will see a light in their breath. And people will say, it looked like the moon, or it looked like the sun, and so on. And these are the forms that light would take on, which are just modes of perception. But what we're actually seeing is, we call this a nimitta or a sign, or that light is a revelation of those hidden dimensions of the sukkhama rupa. The nimitta is in fact sukkhama rupa. The nimitta that we see in meditation, rupa, is a form, right? It's an aspect or a dimension of that subtle body. And it manifests as light. And it manifests as light because it lies close to the nature of knowing and consciousness itself, which reveals itself in a metaphor to the mind as light. Okay, there's no actual light. Right? Knowledge is light. Knowledge of the we describe the mind is describing the breath to us as a light because it wants us to know that the knowledge, the clarity of awareness, is becoming brilliant. And we call this the nimitta. This is an aspect of the kaya, the subtle body, and there's no like break from one to the other. The subtle body is inherent in the physical body all the time, and we are perceiving it in different ways all the time, right? So, for example, another aspect of the subtle body, which I think is kind of interesting, is that like the subtle body has a sense of proprioception, like a sense of space. Like we kind of know where our body is when we're moving through space. I find it interesting. Like I find it interesting when observing people driving the cars. Because I think people's perception of their body actually expands to include the car. Like you're actually driving, and it's weird. I find it weird. Like people will drive their car, and they're like a few inches from a pole on that side, but somehow you have this sense that actually we're good, right? Which you kind of learn. It's a learned skill where you kind of expanded the boundaries of your perception in a certain way to allow you to do that. So in a way, your body is expanding to include the vehicle. Or another example of that might be, let's say, a sports player who is able to perceive not just, say, where the ball is, but to where all the other players are, what the strategic nature of the game is, and all of these other things, to be able to operate in a very fast way. It's what we call situational awareness. So in a way, they're kind of extending their body or honing their physical perceptions in ways that we can't readily explain. And so on. We can think about many examples where this might happen. So this subtle body or subtle kaya is more and more experienced in meditation, but it isn't a one-to-one break. It's a gradually that subtle sukhama kaya is already always there, but becomes more and more prominent, and the experience of the olarika kaya gradually diminishes. And so when meditation becomes deep, and especially in the experience of jhanas, the experience of the olarika kaya disappears completely. So there's no touch sensation of the breath, but there is the physical dimension of that sukhama rupa or that sukhama kaya, the subtle body, which is perceived as a light or some other manifestation like that. And so through the process of meditation, that realization of the subtle body becomes more and more refined until in the formless attainments, the kaya is, of course, gone completely. Even that subtle body is left behind, right? Only four aggregates in the formless attainments. But even there, the Buddha still used the word kaya, interestingly enough, even for realizing the formless attainments, which have no physical dimension. Even the subtle physical dimension are still absent. Yet the Buddha still used the word kaya in that case. He would say like realizing it with the body. So in these kinds of ways, you can see that there is a kind of an idiomatic use of the word kaya from the olarika kaya through to the sukhama kaya, which we can think of as the conscious body or the energetic body or the body of awareness, and then to just awareness itself. And so that the word kaya in those contexts emphasizes the direct personal realization of that experience, even not just the formless attainments, but even nibbana itself. So nibbana itself is said to be realized kayena, with the body. Clearly, the Buddha's not saying with the physical body that one realizes nibbana, but it's that extended understanding of kaya from the olarika kaya to the sukhama kaya to pure experiential realization. Right. So this development of the word kaya through the process of meditation has to be understood in the context of where we are in the meditation. So there's no break from one to the other because it's an evolution. So that's why we use the same word. Okay? Does that make sense, Esther? We good? Excellent. All right, excellent. Moving along, a couple of other questions here. From a Venerable Dhammakippa. So, hello, Bhante, namaskar. Namaskar to you, Venerable. My respects to also the other monastics online, and hello to the community. Yes, so welcome to everybody here, and especially Venerables, we see Venerable Prasanna there, Venerables from Dhammasara, I think, are lurking somewhere. Yes, Venerables, good to see you. And all who have joined us. This weekend, daylight savings time ends in the US, so starting from next Friday, your talks will begin at 3 a.m. Okay. Sorry about that. I'll do my best to attend, but it'll be after the meditation, so 3:30. Okay, no problem. So doubt be able to attend every week. If you can make it even 1 week, we will be very impressed. So, yeah, it's been really nice having your presence here. Tomorrow, Venerable says that she'll go to Ayasu Dhammas Vihara in North Carolina for the robes offering ceremony. Oh, please give my blessings to Venerable Sudhamma, and Ayasobhana will be there as well, and also to Ayasobhana. There won't be enough bhikkhunis for a katina. I'm sorry to hear that. So when is that? Tomorrow. Do we have time to send a quick couple of bhikkhunis over from Australia?
What happens if don't go to America?
That is correct. Yeah, don't go to America. Yeah. I'm sorry. If it weren't for ICE, then we'd probably be able to do it. But not at this time. Anyway, look. So good to hear that. And have a wonderful time there. So, okay. Tessa asks, On the subject of time, would you say that Buddhism has a view of circular time instead of a linear progressing time? Yes and no. Okay, next question. Of course, these are metaphors, right? So time isn't either a line or a circle, but these are metaphors which we can use to somehow describe time. Right? But time is a kind of a weird thing that doesn't—it's not really easy to characterize. Even in physics, they have a difficulty in characterizing the true nature of time, and different kind of theories about it. From a Buddhist perspective, the Buddha didn't really define time in the suttas, but my interpretation based on the suttas and also based on the various Abhidhamma and later discussions of the question, I would define time from a Buddhist perspective as time is a concept which is derived from the memory of changes in experience. Okay, let me repeat that. Time is a concept which is derived from the memory of the changes in experience. So the primary thing is experience. And experience doesn't contain time. It just is. We are just here. And we would have, what is our notion of time? Well, we remember that there was another experience a while ago. And maybe it's not just memories, but also expectations, right? We expect that there'll be another experience in a little while. But memories are usually clearer, right? I suspect memories are primary because expectations are more vague. But anyway, so we have an experience, which is the reality, and then we have this thing in our mind we call memory, which was that there was another experience which was different. And so we invent a concept to describe the space between here and there, and we call that space time. Right? So that's my understanding from a Buddhist point of view of that. So one implication of this is that time is not something which is existent. It's not something which is like a fundamental property of the universe. It's a way of describing and making sense of experience. All right, so the question of time is, was Buddhism circular time or linear time? I prefer to think of time in Buddhism as a spiral, okay? So a spiral is both linear and circular, right? If you look at a spiral from far enough away, then it looks like a line. And if you look at it from close enough up, it looks like a circle. So it depends how you look at it. So that idea of a spiral is, I think, very evocative, right? It relates to DNA, relates to seashells, it relates to galaxies. And we see these shapes of spirals everywhere in the universe, everywhere in life, wherever we look. Things change, but they follow the same pattern. They don't exactly repeat, but the same kind of thing repeats. Yeah, that's what a spiral is. Yeah. So it's neither completely circular nor is it completely linear. So one of the things that suggests to us is that through the recognition of patterns, then we can understand how that spiral works. And that's very much, for example, how the process of meditation goes. When we talk about meditation, we use nice, comforting metaphors like path. We have a path in meditation. A path is something you start in one place, and you walk down and you end up at another place. It's a nice comforting metaphor. But the reality, as we know, for those of us who've been meditating for a while, is that it's not quite that simple, because we often feel like we're starting in one place, walking along the road. I was here like an hour ago. That's literally exactly the same place. And our thoughts, we use words like, oh, our thoughts are running around in circles, right? So we actually feel like we're going around in circles a lot. But then it's not exactly the same, is it? Right? Because whenever the thoughts, even they're going around in circles, they're never exactly the same the second time. Right? So meditation also has that kind of shape of being like a spiral. All right. Letty asks, Bhante, what is your favorite question to answer and why? Letty, my favorite question to answer is any question that you ask. I'm sorry, I shouldn't play favoritism, but anyway, my favorite question, being a bit more sensible, my favorite question to answer, like I like difficult questions. I like questions that are meaningful and real. I like all kinds of questions. Like I like philosophical questions, and I like questions that are unexpected and personal, you know. So I find, you know, questions fun. Yeah, but I do like things that are a bit weird and unexpected. Okay, so Venerable Prasanna says, is the subtle body the same thing as a Manomaya Kaya? I would say yes, it is. Or perhaps it might be a way of saying that the Manomaya Kaya is the mind-made body. Perhaps another way of saying that perhaps the mind-made body is one aspect of the Sukhamakaya. Yeah, I suspect Sukhamakaya is probably more of a general category. The Manomaya Kaya is specifically that aspect of the Sukhamakaya which is associated with an individual body. Whereas Sukhamakaya, I think, or Sukhamarupa is more general. Yeah. Okie dokie. Dhirayupa. Swadiyam Beningaibang. Meditation session. Question. A friend is meditating and feeling like she is floating in the air. Awesome. What should she do? Okay. Has she got her visa? Okay. No. She usually does breath meditation. Okay. Oh, good. Oh, that's cool. So it's quite common for meditators to have these kinds of experiences. Also, it's quite common for meditators to not have these experiences. So don't worry if you're having these experiences, and don't worry if you're not. And floating in the air comes because, so let's backtrack a little bit and talk about how the process of meditation works. We've already talked about how the breath is changing in your meditation, how your perception of the breath is changing, right? We started with the perception of the breath just as physical air, and we're moving and we're transforming that perception to see it as something which is much more energetic, much more subtle, and much more emotional as well. And it's not just the breath that feels like that, but your whole body can change, like your perception of your whole body changes. And again, it's very common that this happens in meditation. Usually in meditation, you'll end up with your body feeling a bit more placid, a bit more comfortable, a bit more relaxed than you were at the beginning, right? So this is a very common change that people have in meditation, but there are also less common ones as well. Sometimes they're not pleasant. Sometimes you might feel like your body's really itchy, or perhaps you might feel like your body's really hot, or perhaps your body might start shaking. So you can all have these different phenomena happen, which are manifestations of the changing in perception and the changing in energies. Basically, how I like to think about these things is that we have, our body, right? Again, the word body is like a composite of many different things. And those different things have energies and tensions locked up in them. Sometimes these are like old emotions or injuries or whatever, and our emotional and psychological energy can be locked up in these. Sometimes it's just subconscious, right? Sometimes it's just purely a physical thing, and it's kind of locked up in there. And as we meditate, we start to open those things up, and the energy starts to flow more easily, and we experience this as these different kinds of reactions and so on in the body. Now, if that is flowing well, and if the energy in your body, your Sukhamakaya, your subtle body, if the energy in your subtle body is strong, and if you're having a positive rapture experience, that is, a feeling of rapture is a positive emotional response to your meditation, then you can feel so light that you feel like you're floating up in the air. All right. And if you're sitting there with your eyes closed and you feel like you're floating up in the air, then just enjoy it. It's nice. Yeah. And don't open your eyes. If you think, okay, some people say that they will actually fly up in the air. Okay, I've never seen it myself. This is one of the great regrets of my life. I was in Bodh Gaya in the evening in the Japanese temple talking with a local Hindu sadhu, and we had a lovely chat about all kinds of things. And at one point in the evening, he said to me, "You know, I can fly." I'm like, "Really?" He said, "Yes, do you want to see?" And in a moment of madness, I said, "Oh, no, never mind. I thought I was too cool for that. Don't worry about it." And like an instant later, I was like, "Why did I say that?" Anyway, so that was, I do not have many regrets in my life, but that is one of them. Anyway, so some people think you can fly. I've never seen it personally, but certainly you can have a perception that you're flying. If you think that you are actually flying, all right, don't open your eyes, okay? Use a webcam, okay? Sit in front of the webcam and then meditate, and then if you're levitating, right, you've got it on camera, okay? That would be excellent. That would be seriously viral, right? Once you put that on TikTok, then you're good to go. But yeah, it's good. It's a nice experience. It's the experience of floating. Usually what will happen is that if you stay with those experiences, you just stay mindful, okay? Don't get too caught up in those experiences. Keep coming back to the feeling of the breath. At that point, the breath will be very subtle, and so you just notice that the very tender, very silky touch of the breath. Okay. And they just keep with that as precisely as possible, right? And generally speaking, those perceptions will pass and the mind will kind of normalize and come back into balance. Okay, very good. Carpioception, I'm not familiar with that word. Okay, Simran asks, "Bhante, can you please clarify the difference between the brain and mind in terms of function?" Oh my goodness. Well, I do like a challenge. So the Buddha talked a lot about the mind. He didn't really talk much about the brain at all, curiously enough. And it's one of those kind of oddities about suttas and about, I think, ancient Indian writings and thought in general that doesn't really mention the brain or give much significance to it. It was kind of weird, I think. Like there's obviously so much like biological knowledge and so on. It's not like they didn't know how these things worked, and yet there's very little said about the brain. I don't really know why that's the case. But clearly the brain is closely associated with and closely connected with all kinds of cognitive functions. And yet at the same time, its connection with those cognitive functions is not entirely clear, and it's not really well understood, particularly not well understood on a theoretical level. Like, we can practically do a lot of things with brains. We can hook them up to machines. We can do readouts of them, and we can, you know, dissect them and so on, hopefully like after they're, you know, dead. But we can do all of these kinds of things and have, you know, much more refined understanding of the brain than we did a little while ago. But our theoretical understanding hasn't necessarily really changed. So there's a relationship, clearly a relationship between the brain and our experience. Now, a lot of people, like a lot of kind of default view is that the mind is the brain, right? And that people believe that science has somehow kind of proven this. This is a fallacy, because science can't prove anything like that. So science can look at the brain, but science doesn't really have anything to say about the relationship between brain and mind per se. This is a topic that's been debated as ad nauseum in philosophy for many years. And the fact is that the experience that we have is quite a different thing from brain things. Like the experience of the color red is a completely different thing from the part of the brain that lights up when you see that color red. They're like completely different things, and there's no easy or one-to-one relationship between brain things and mind things. So people do this kind of thing all the time where they say, "Let's look for compassion." we'll stick a monk in an MRI machine, right? Map his brain, get him to do some compassion meditation. Lovely. We found compassion. This is great, right? So I refute this argument with the simile of the golfer, okay? So there is a golfer. The golfer wants to understand what is golf. It's a mystery. So they put their brain, they can even put their whole body, but they can put their brain into an MRI machine. And then they go out on the golf course. It's a portable MRI machine. And they go out to the golf course and they hit the golf ball, and you measure like what parts of the brain light up when you hit the golf ball. And you say, hey, we've discovered golf. That's what golf is, right? I mean, it's nonsense, obviously, right? You can say that those brain functions are in some way associated with the game of golf, sure, because you're using certain muscle groups or so on. Maybe you're strategizing. Maybe there's an emotional feeling. So there can actually be all kinds of things you might associate with that, right? You can learn things from understanding how the brain responds with golf, but you haven't found golf. You haven't really learned anything interesting about the game of golf, right? And you're not necessarily becoming a better golfer by doing that, right? And so we think we've identified compassion in the brain, but no, actually, we've just identified an area where more blood has flown at a certain time and therefore is creating a larger signal on the MRI machine, which reacts to the iron in the blood and so on. And we're generalizing from that to say that this is where compassion is. So I think we need to just be, I think all this kind of research is interesting, but we just need to be quite humble about like what we can really draw from that. So from a Buddhist point of view, the mind and brain are not the same, but Buddhism is not a mind-brain dualism. Okay, so let me just explain that briefly. In the beginning of the Bible, we have Adam. Adam is just made of mud. God comes along and breathes the spirit into him. Suddenly we've got a person. Fine, right? We have the body is one thing. You have the spirit or the soul or the mind is another thing. We're going to put them together, right? This is mind-body dualism. Two separate entities, two separate things that somehow are fused together. Now, obviously, that's a mythological tale. But that idea of mind-body dualism has been fundamental in Western thought down through the years. The mind is one thing, the body is the other thing. We can think of it as the body as being the brain. The brain is one thing, the mind is another thing. You can think of it as the soul or the spirit, but they're separate things, separate entities. And this mind-body dualism is like a zombie that has stalked the halls of Western philosophy for 1,000 years. Because it's based on a completely false assumption, which is that the mind or the body are things. They are not. They are networks. They are processes. They are relationships. They are energies. From a Buddhist point of view, it isn't the case that the body is a thing and the mind is a thing and somehow we have to put these things together. From a Buddhist point of view, what's real is our experience. You're sitting there right now. You're experiencing. What do you? Well, you see, you hear, you think, you have memory, you touch, you have feelings, you have emotions. All of these that blooming, buzzing confusion of the reality of experience is the primary truth of our lives. That is what is real. If anything is real, that experience is primary. So everything else is a description of that. We can describe experience in various ways. We can abstract it. We can divide it. We can categorize it. And we can say, well, within this experience, there are certain things that have certain properties. For example, there are certain things that have the property of not passing through one another, like that, right? And we can call this physical, patiga sampasa. when sound hits your ears, it creates a reaction. That has a certain kind of property to it when light hits the eyes, when something touches your skin. But there are other things that don't have that property of bumping into each other, but they have another property which is being associated with naming and language. We can call that another dimension of our experience. And so we can abstract out different dimensions of experience. We can do that in different ways for different purposes. But the primary reality is the experience itself. All right? So we can compare this with, let's say, something like an ecosystem. When you walk into an ecosystem, everything is just there. Water is there, plants are there, animals are there, insects are buzzing, ground is there. All of these things are happening, all of this complexity. Right? It's not that there were animals and plants and then they got put together. Right? It's that there was an ecosystem that evolved, and we can distinguish these we put together as animals, these we put together as plants, maybe some we can't easily distinguish as either plants or animals. Right? It's a system, it's a relationship. Right? So the relationship, the difference between the mind and the brain in Buddhism is that the mind is the primary reality. What we experience is the mind. It's the things that are seen, heard, smelt, taste, touched, the things that we think and so on. This is the primary reality, which is all experienced in the mind, and it's different aspects of the mind. The brain is a physical organ which has some complex dependent relationships with the mind. Now, the materialist hypothesis is that the brain causes the mind. Well, that's one materialist hypothesis. Another materialist hypothesis is that the mind is an illusion and the brain actually is the mind, right? Or that the mind is an epiphenomenon of the brain. There's different kinds of theories. There's not like one materialist theory. There's a bunch of them. But there are different ways of thinking about the relationship between the mind and the brain. So one of the problems, maybe just shut the door. So the idea of, I'm not sure how this is sounding online, but we just had some kind of machine has started out here. What are they doing? There we go. We're off. Great. Okay, so a lot of people have this idea of the epiphenomenon idea. Epiphenomenon idea is ridiculous. Okay, so the idea of an epiphenomenon is that you have something, some kind of system that reaches a certain level of complexity, and then you have some kind of epiphenomenon which arises from that. So a classic idea might be something like let's say, a TV program. Okay, so you have a TV screen. It has all of the stuff that goes there, the plastic that makes the frame. It has the wires, all of the parts, the speakers, all of those kinds of things. And when you have that system assembled in a certain way, and then you have the input, the electronic input in a certain way, which may be the broadcast waves or maybe from your player or internet or whatever, then that's giving a stream of electric impulses that are then stimulating the stream to light up the diodes in the screen, to make the speakers vibrate back and forth, and then you have a story. And the story is of two star-crossed lovers who fall in love but then get separated by the impositions of an unjust society or whatever. But that story is not in the screen, it's not in the wires, it's not in any of those things. The story is something which is a communication from the mind of the storyteller. And yet from a physical point of view, you can say that the story emerges as an epiphenomenon from the screen. But the problem here, and the reason why I say the epiphenomenon idea is ridiculous, is because the story cannot influence the screen. The screen influences the story, right? If the screen is broken, for example, the way you receive the story is different, right? Or if it only half works. But
the fact that the story has a happy, that our lovers are united happily in the end, doesn't mean you get a screen upgrade. Oh yeah, I had it was such a good show last night. My screen, I swear, it started out as a 2K screen, and by the end of the show, it was 4K. It was such a good show, right? This doesn't happen, right? Epiphenomena go one way, right? But with organic systems like the mind and the brain, they're constantly interrelating. And your mind is affecting your brain just as much as your brain is affecting the mind. So to me, the whole epiphenomenon idea is ridiculous. It's a complete non-starter. But there are other ways of conceiving about the relationship between the mind and the body. One which was advanced is a book called The Irreducible Mind, which contains a sort of a collection of all of the weird and wonderful studies that have been done on inexplicable things. Great book if you get the chance to read it. But the theory that they give there, which I think was an interesting one, which was that the brain functions as a switchboard. So the brain is like a kind of an interface that interprets the mind and transmits it for the body. So it acts as a way for the mind and the body to work together or something like that. So I think this is an interesting way of thinking about it. And I certainly think if we're thinking of things in terms of like an interface or a network or relationship, is going to be closer to reality than thinking about it as an epiphenomenon. Okay, great. Thank you. Yes, Shenny.
Can we look at the brain and mind, the brain is the
Olarika.
Olarika.
Right.
And the mind is the Sukha.
So the question was, can we see the brain as olarika and the mind as sukkama? Well, to a certain degree, yes, because the brain certainly is olarika rupa, right? And it would have a sukkama rupa attached to it, right, or associated with it in some way, yeah? But the mind is also not, I think, just limited to that, though, because I think the mind is, because the mind isn't rupa as such, that the mind perceives rupa, but the mind actually isn't rupa. Yeah. Anyway, moving on. Dhira Yupa asks, a friend said that one time she sat to meditate in a few minutes. So is this a friend? Anyway, moving on. A few minutes, she felt like she entered and stayed in a silent and peaceful room, hearing and feeling nothing else. What is it? And what should she do next? Well, your friend should keep meditating because she's doing great. And that sounds like a really nice meditation experience. It's very difficult to be able to really interpret or understand what particular experiences that people are having in meditation, especially over just a simple Zoom session or something like that. So if I was to want to sort of get to the bottom to understand it, I want to talk to somebody at length about their experience, but also I want to know who that person is. I want to know how they live their life. I want to know how they go about meditation, about what the process of going into meditation was, about how they felt for the days and weeks afterwards, how it changed their attitudes. So meditation is not just a one-dimensional or simple thing. And the way that people report their meditation is complicated to interpret or understand. I mean, just a very simple thing, you know, saying that meditation was like sitting in a silent and peaceful room, and that sounds great, but what does that mean exactly? Like, you could imagine that somebody's doing a guided meditation and they begin the guided meditation and say, imagine you're sitting in a silent and peaceful room, right? Oh yes, I imagined I was sitting in a silent peaceful room. So it could mean anything, you know. And it sounds likely that your friend had a more profound experience than that, right? So, but it's difficult to say in such a context. Yeah, but keep practicing. If you're enjoying your meditation, if you're experiencing peace, then you're doing it right. That's great. Okay, so can a monastic who is able to read minds misinterpret your thoughts? Good question. Yes. According to Buddhism, that it's possible to be able to read minds. Again, I understand this. I understand like reading minds. Again, we can understand it through the idea of the Sukhamakaya. So if we think of the Sukhamakaya as being an energetic body that has an actual physical
manifestation or relation or like a manifestation that relates to the sukhamakayas around us. Like I think our subtle bodies or our energies are kind of leaky, right? But like, you know, and that's again, it's like heat, it's like everything, like the heat on our bodies is kind of leaky, right? Or different kinds of things. They're not confined to our skin. And so the energy kind of is manifesting and it reflects our brain energy and reflects our mind energy. And I think these fields are what people are picking up on. I think it's what we normally pick up on when we're just intuitive about people's moods. I don't think it's mysterious. I think it's just a normal thing that we do. You walk into a room, if two people have been arguing, you pick up that there's a bad vibe. So I think we're doing it all the time. But some meditators are able to take that to a deeper level and be able to pick it up much more subtly. So can such a person misinterpret your thoughts? Yes, very much so. Because first of all, being able to read minds doesn't mean that you're necessarily enlightened. So somebody who has that ability might themselves be subject to greed, hatred, and delusion, and therefore can misinterpret things. Or they only have a partial picture. So just because they can read a thought that you're having doesn't mean that they know everything about you. It just means that they know that. Right, so they can't know what came before or came afterwards. Maybe they read you your thought. You're reading there, sitting there, thinking, "Oh God, this talk is going on for such a long time. When is he going to finish?" Right, but then but then the next minute you're like, "No, hang on, no. Actually, no. It's actually pretty good. Yeah, so it's all right." But they didn't catch that bit, right? Right. So obviously it's possible to misinterpret. So any of these things have to be carried with a lot of caution. Okay. A few more questions. I'm going to have to answer. Thanks so much for your good questions. I've been answering some of them at quite some length, but I'll just zip through the next ones a bit more quickly, if you don't mind. So in the Dhammasarananda asking, MN33, greed, hatred, and delusion are makers of signs. What does signs mean in that case? So I think in that case, signs is explained as being, basically in that case, the signs or the nimitta are the like conditions or the causes or the indications that are associated with suffering. So if you have greed, hatred, and delusion, if you have greed, then the nimitta or the sign that's associated with that is something that you want, right? And so then you go after that and then you create suffering because of it. So I think that's the meaning there. When would perceptions like flying in meditation start getting delusional, right? So, yeah, good point. It could easily happen that it becomes delusional if you have a strong belief that you're flying in meditation, okay? So in Australia in the late 90s, we actually had a flying meditation political party. Anyone remember these guys? It feels like this fever dream that I had that there was legitimately a political party in Australia where they were like, we're going to have an army of flying meditators, I kid you not, who are going to surround Australia with a force field of flying meditation energy that, and we can then disband all our armed forces and we'll live peacefully and happily. No? Nobody remembers? A few people remembering. This was actually a real thing that happened in Australia, which, by the way, is very much a real country. Okay, so... Was it in WA? She says, yes, if it happened in WA, it's not real because it's over there, right? I think it was national. And I met this one guy who was doing this actually. I was just walking through Central Station and this guy came up and started talking about meditation and he was part of this group and saying, so it's like trying to do it. And I'm like, what do they do? Actually, what they do is just like sit on their beds and bounce up and down in an effort to sort of learn how to fly. But he had a problem that his floor wasn't great, so the leg of his chair went into the room down below. But anyway, the idea is that you can fly. And so on. So at that point, yes, definitely is getting delusional. Yeah. So if you ever think to yourself, this meditation experience is so great, I should form a political party, then it's probably time to start questioning. But no, more seriously, yes, so those things can easily become delusional. So meditation masters will usually, you know, be quite circumspect around those things. They're not necessarily going to dismiss them or anything, but they say don't get too caught up in them. It's just experiences you can happen. Isn't there a story in the suttas about someone performing brain surgery? There is indeed, actually, in the Vinaya. in the story of Jivaka, the Buddha's physician, that he extracted a creature of some kind, which is obviously a brain tumor or something like that, and then the person survived. So, yes, there is brain surgery in the suttas. Ah, we need a reference to brain surgery. Thanks. So we've got the reference there from Venerable Prasanna. Venerable Prasanna suggests perhaps that or that a young medical student suggested that the reason the Buddha didn't mention the brain in the list of body parts is because it's got no tactile sensation, whereas the rest of the organs and parts we can feel. Bone marrow? I don't know. I feel like there are a few there that we can't really feel that well. Anyway, it's interesting. So, yeah, so Venerable Prasanna has also supplied the link in the Vinaya for that reference of brain surgery. The story of Jivaka, quite apart from that episode, is really interesting in many regards. Okay, when you have a headache, you can feel the brain, maybe. I can feel the brain. I think I can feel the brain in some circumstances. Brain zap, maybe. Brain facts. Brainfacts.org says this is not the brain but tissue. Okay. Not sure what the difference is, but anyway, fine. Okay, Tim. Tim says, my friend has chronic facial pain, which sometimes makes it really difficult for him to get calmer and creates obstacles for letting go process, making the mind agitated. Any suggestion? Okay, so this is the kind of problem that meditators can often face because when you have a particular issue, which might be very specific and very particular to you, but it can flare up in meditation in ways that make it difficult. It's not uncommon that these kinds of things would happen. Meditation tends to intensify things. So if you have chronic facial pain, you sit down to meditate, you become more aware of it. And then, of course, then that can create that cycle where the more aware of it, the more intense it becomes and so on. So it can be quite easy to get caught in that cycle and difficult to break away from it. So my compassion for your friend there, first thing that I would suggest is to try a few different kinds of meditation, especially ones that did not focus on the face. So for that thing, I would avoid mindfulness of breathing. Walking meditation might be a good one, right? Paying attention to the feet, which is as far away from your face as you can get. Or perhaps something like kasina meditation, where you're focusing originally on an object outside the body. Like you can focus on a body of water and remind yourself water, 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 and to bring that into your body as well. Or other meditations like metta or meditations that are grounded in the body. First recommendation. The second thing that I would say is be careful about getting caught up in that cycle and don't judge your meditation by comparing it to somebody who's not going through that same experience. So your primary goal in your practice then is to be able to meditate free of a condition. Now, so if that means just meditating for a couple of minutes, not longer, just a couple of minutes, and then, oh, you feel that worry starting to happen, just stop. Come out of the meditation, do something else. Come back again, try the meditation, and if you feel that worry coming off, stop. Come out of the meditation mindfully and go and do something else. And do that as often as you need to, because you want to break the pattern in your mind that tells you that meditation is associated with this pain, all right? You don't want to develop that condition. You want to be able to say that you're going to meditate and it doesn't have that pain in it. So you do that as often as you can, and practicing the meditation that's not face-focused. Okay, great. Oh, thank you. Letty's given us a link to the Flying Yogis. That's extremely useful. Thank you. And Diri Yupa says, could we give a guided meditation on a kasina next week? Okay, maybe. I haven't done that much kasina meditation. I've done a little bit now and then, but yeah, we could maybe. I'll try reminding me next week and we'll see how we go. Thanks. All right, everybody, thanks. We should wrap up about now. Thanks to all of those who've come to join us here in Parramatta, and also thanks to those who've joined us online from all around the world. Special compassion to folks in the US for having to get up so very early. Hopefully we'll see you again. Just a couple of quick messages. So the Meta Convention is next weekend, is that correct? So the next weekend. So if you haven't got your tickets, then get your tickets for the Meta Convention organized by the Meta Center here in Sydney. And lots of visiting teachers and so on. So that will be fun. For those in the States, I'm actually doing an event on Sunday with my friend Chade Meng Tan. And here's a session called Vibe with Venerables. And I don't have the link with me, but if you search for Vibe with Venerables, you should probably find it, and Chade Meng Tan. So we're going to have a conversation and so on and so forth, so that should be entertaining, hopefully. And what else is happening? All right. So on Monday week, that's Monday, November the 10th, there's going to be 15 Sangha going for Pindabhata in Harris Park. So we're going to... show Harris Park something it's never seen before. And so that'll be fun. So if you want to come and join us there, we're going for Pindabhata, and we will be having the Dana in the local Rosella Park, weather permitting. Meanwhile, similar but on a much smaller scale, tomorrow I'll be going Pindabhata in Harris Park with a couple of visiting venerables from the City of 10,000 Buddhas in the US. And so they're visiting Australia, and they just met them today, and we had the opportunity to go for Pindabhata tomorrow. So if you're around in Sydney, come along to Harris Park tomorrow, usual time, by the post office at 11 o'clock, and get to meet some visiting venerables. Okay. Thanks, everybody. May you be happy. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu.